Well, yeah, actually the plant itself is going to be about 20 miles south of Eagle Pass, Texas. And the way the airflow goes, because of the Gulf, will blow all of the emissions from this power plant into Big Bend and the Sierra del Carmen's site in northern Mexico. The missions project manager for the Carbon 2 plant has outright said that Mission considers itself under no obligation to meet U.S. standards, and they don't think that they even have to provide the EPA with any information on the plant's operation, capacity, or emissions, because they're not on U.S. territory. They're mere 20 miles from the U.S. border, but they still say that.
NAFTA invests a lot of authority in dispute resolution panels, which consist of 5 trade lawyers who will decide whether or not a U.S. law can be struck down.
So it puts U.S. sovereignty in the hands of lawyers,
exactly,
and private groups.
Exactly. And it threatens many of the laws that we as environmentalists have fought for years and years through a democratic process to achieve.
Mexico is having problems enforcing its laws as it is. They made a big deal about the fact, a great deal has been made about how they've hired all these additional environmental investigators and inspectors along the border region, but an article in the Times came out last week. They haven't paid any of these people for 5 months, so of the several hundred that 200 that they hired, they're now down to a handful because they haven't been paid.
A big Mexican power plant on the border of the United States, a lot of pollution, and it all fits in with GATT and NAFTA. We'll talk about this right now on Alternative Views.
Today on Alternative Views, we have with us 2 experts on the North American Free Trade Agreement, which you may have been seeing more and more about in the mainstream press as the ratification vote seems to be impending. With us are Christopher Green, a Harvard Law student who's done research for the Texas Center for Policy Studies, and a former visitor on Alternative Views, James Scott, a public policy analyst with Public Citizen. My first question is for James. James, there's been quite a bit of urgency associated with the NAFTA issue recently. Why is it that the Clinton administration seems so dead set on pushing this issue through and ratifying the agreement?
Well, Ali, the problem with this has from the beginning been a urgency placed upon this process by external political forces. President Bush was under a quick timetable to get this agreement finished before his election, and in order to help him gain votes in states like Texas and California. Now there's an urgency based on propping up the government of President Carlos Salinas in Mexico. Salinas his term expires very soon, and he needs to be able to amass the political capital, if you will, to within the pre-party to choose his successor. The U.S. has decided that Salinas is our man, and the U.S. government feels that if NAFTA is not ratified, it'll create a backlash against Salinas, who has invested so much of his political capital in this deal with the United States.
So the U.S. has decided that it needs to just push through, rather the present U.S. administration has decided it needs to push through the NAFTA agreement to sort of save Salinas from the political risks he's taken, but it seems like there are some very vocal critics. of NAFTA in the U.S. For instance, Ross Perot, who's been against the this free trade agreement since the beginning. Are there any political risks or liabilities that President Clinton may be taking upon himself?
Yeah, President Clinton's taking some very serious risks. First and foremost is the risk that, as critics predict, there will be great job loss to Mexico as a result of the North American Free Trade Agreement. This could be seen real clearly in the example of what happened under the U.S.-Canadian Free Trade Agreement. At that time, economic models predicted that there would be job growth in Canada, job growth in the U.S., just as these same similar type models are trying to predict now. What happened in Canada was manufacturing jobs fled to the U.S. They've lost several hundred thousand jobs, and much of that's due to the recession, the worldwide recession, but a great deal of it is also due to the U.S.-Canadian Free Trade Agreement. Consequently, President Mulroney of Canada, or Prime Minister Mulroney, I'm sorry, became very, very unpopular. He had popularity ratings, which he would be very envious of someone like Richard Nixon at the height of Watergate, because he and his party were perceived to have caused the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs through the free trade deal with the U.S. Consequently, this agreement was rushed through in Canada before the upcoming elections, which the ruling party, the Mulroney party, is surely to lose.
Also, people have cited environmental concerns about the impact of NAFTA, aside from the impact on jobs. Could you tell me what the general environmental concerns are, both of you?
Essentially, the concerns fall into two basic categories. One is concern over effects on U.S. environmental laws. Under NAFTA, as with other international trade agreements, a law which inhibits trade can be challenged and struck down as a trade barrier. And the U.S. has many, many environmental laws which extend beyond our borders. They affect pesticide residues, they affect the importation of endangered species. Some states may choose to prohibit the export of timber in an effort to manage the forest more successfully. What this means is, if the U.S. is to pass a law which impedes trade in any way with one of the partners, Canada or Mexico, or if a state or a county or a local government does the same, the other parties to NAFTA can challenge, and that law will be struck down. We've seen examples of this under the current GATT. Right now, Europe's challenging the U.S. on corporate average fuel economy standards. And this is under the GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. NAFTA is like a little brother to GATT, and NAFTA invests a lot of authority in dispute resolution panels, which consist of five trade lawyers who will decide whether or not a U.S. law can be struck down.
So it puts U.S. sovereignty in the hands of lawyers,
exactly,
and private groups.
Exactly. And it threatens many of the laws that we as environmentalists have fought for years and years through a democratic process to achieve. The thought that these laws can be struck down at the whim of a panel of trade bureaucrats is very disconcerting to most environmentalists. The second issue that we have of concern to us is the issue of companies fleeing the United States to avoid U.S. environmental restrictions and using Mexico as a dumping ground, polluting the air and polluting the water, which in many cases comes back over here. Currently, there's a Maquiladora free trade zone that's been in existence since the late 60s along the U.S.-Mexico border. Pollution there is abysmal. These companies don't adhere to anywhere near the pollution control requirements they're required to do here in this country. And these plants have attracted tens or hundreds of thousands of people from the interior of Mexico to these towns on the border, where basic infrastructure is just not adequate. There are no water treatment plants. There is inadequate sewage treatment. In many of these colonias which surround these plants, there's no running water. There is no electricity. And it's very disconcerting to see, when you go down there, as I've done, the richest corporations in the world, GM, it's a who's who, General Electric, surrounded by shanty towns of the people who work for them, who are living in basically in squalor. So there's a lot of environmental pressures, population pressures, in an area that's very arid, has very little water to start with, and what it does have is now being polluted through chemicals from these plants and from sewage from the shanty towns that surround these plants.
Chris, you recently authored a report called The Carbon II Dilemma, a case study of the failings of U.S.-Mexico environmental management in the border region. This has to do with power generation in the region just south of Big Bend National Park.
Well, yeah, actually the plant itself is going to be about 20 miles south of Eagle Pass, Texas. And the way the airflow goes because of the Gulf will blow all of the emissions from this power plant into Big Bend and the Sierra del Carmen's site in northern Mexico. The plant itself is very large. It's about 1,400 megawatts, and there's an existing, it's called Carbon 2, there's an existing plant at the site called Carbon 1, which many U.S. agencies only just found out about. So together, this facility will be over 2,600 megawatts. By comparison, the large Navajo generating station in the west is only about 2,000 megawatts, so it's a very as large a facility as exists in the U.S. and will definitely be the largest energy facility in the border region.
What substances do these plants use to produce energy?
Well, the plants, Carbon 1 is coal-fired, using moderate sulfur, high ash, low BTU coal. Low BTU meaning you have to burn a lot of this to get the energy content, so therefore you create more emissions of various pollutants, sulfur dioxide. The high ash will mean there's a lot of particulate matter, nitrogen oxides, and others. And the problem is Carbon 1 has no controls, no environmental controls whatsoever. The proposed Carbon 2 project, which is about half built, supposedly will have protection for particulates, although those won't be that effective because they remove only a very narrow range. And don't remove the small particles, 10 microns and less, that cause a vast majority of visibility damage. And also sulfur dioxide. There are no controls for sulfur dioxide on the Carbon 2 plant, which is the leading cause of visibility damage.
What companies are responsible for bringing these plants into being? And also, if I'm not mistaken, isn't this area fairly desolate? Where's this power going to be?
That's a good question. The plant itself is being built by the Comisión Federal de Electricidad, which is Mexico's energy agency, basically. They're rumored to be close to bankrupt, so they sought financing to complete this project. There's a consortium that's going to be sold, hopefully on their part, to a consortium of businesses. One is called Energen, and it is comprised of Alto Hornos, which is a steel operation in Mexico, which will receive 10% of the output of the plant for one of its steel mills in nearby Monclova. And the other Mexican partner is Macari, a mining conglomerate who expects to provide most of the 5 million tons of coal needed per year for this plant. They will own 51% of the operation. The other 49% would be owned by a group called Mission Energy, which is itself a subsidiary of SCE Corp, which owns Southern California Edison. All these groups are somewhat suspect. Macari's had some problems with labor operations at their mines. Alto Hornos was recently, I don't know the correct status, but it was chastised by the U.S. government, and I think there's actually federal action for their dumping Mexican steel on the U.S. market.
Now, under NAFTA, there wouldn't be any possibility of such charges. They'd be able to just sell steel in the U.S. market as much as they wanted.
Primarily, yeah, but there's still a problem with dumping. You're still, under NAFTA and GATT, you're still not allowed to sell a product in another country at a lower price than it costs to produce it, or that you sell it, or would sell it in your host country. But that the second part of that is, I mean, they say lower price than you sell in your host country, but it's really not enforced that much. But the production is still, people still pay attention to.
What about Mission Energy? What interest do they have in this plant?
Well, that's interesting. SCE Corp which owns, as I said, owns Mission and Southern California Edison. Southern California Edison prides itself on being a quote-unquote green utility, and they made a big deal of publicizing their different efficiency programs, and that made a big factor. They're going to lower their carbon dioxide emissions by a certain percentage.
And they've advertised this, I take
it.
Oh,
highly, yes.
It's part of the green campaign that
Surely.
We see from a lot of major U.S. corporations.
Sure.
Where they tout their environmental concern and how they're helping out, being good corporate citizens.
Certainly. And a lot of people bought it because, interestingly, the CEO of SE Corp is John Bryson, who was one of the original co-founders of NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council. One of the leading advocates of environmental litigation.
Mm-hmm.
While Southern California Edison are making these claims, their other arm, Mission Energy, and the name itself implies they're going into third world nations and setting up these large-scale power plants, many of which do not have environmental controls, such as Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, several other countries have got similar operations. So it says in the annual report for last year of SEE Corp, says they've invested $310 million for the plant and associated coal resources.
Carbon-2?
Yeah, well, the carbon-2 plant.
Right.
And so it's not sure what the associated coal resources means. There's an additional issue, which is a whole separate sub-issue, but right now a company called Dos Repúblicas is trying to set up a open-pit strip mine for coal in Eagle Pass itself, actually within the municipal boundaries. That itself is a whole other environmental catastrophe. Open pit strip mining, so it's almost never reclaimed. The land is almost never reclaimed. Turns out there could be a alluvial. Turns out it's very close to the Rio Grande, Rio Bravo region, the watershed. A lot of the runoff from this mining operation will go right into there and further pollute the already devastated Rio Grande. So it's not sure exactly, but in the ownership, certain claims have been made by the mayor of Eagle Pass and others that there is an ownership connection between Dos Repúblicas and Mission Energy or the other consortium. And this is all to supply coal to carbon-2, although publicly that's always denied by the companies, and it's still not sure what the true deal is there.
Here you have Mission Energy, an arm of the very green energy, U.S. energy company, SCE Corporation, operating a power plant about 20 miles from the U.S. border. What measures have they taken to protect the U.S. environment? Because it seems like there's going to be a lot of overflow from this plant into the U.S., let alone the Mexican environment.
Well, Mission makes no excuses for its operations in other countries. Tom Reed, Mission's project manager for the carbon-2 plant, has outright said that Mission considers itself under no obligation to meet U.S. standards, and they don't think that they even have to provide the EPA with any information on the plant's operation, capacity, or emissions because they're not on U.S. territory. They're mere 20 miles from the U.S. border, but they still say that. More importantly, the pollution from this plant will blow all directly into Big Bend. And it's not just a case of U.S. citizens saying, well, Mexico is developing and it's going to affect our beautiful scenery. The emission levels of sulfur dioxide and particulates are so high from this plant that the sulfur dioxide exceeds even basic human health standards for the Piedras Negras area, Eagle Pass area. Also, many crop species are killed at very low levels of sulfur dioxide, and there's a lot of crop development and irrigation that goes on in that region.
Also, the U.S. has set standards for industrial development tied to the level of sulfur dioxide in the air. Could these high levels of sulfur dioxide have an effect on industrial development in the U.S. on the other side of the border?
Certainly, and that's a primary worry of U.S. industrialists. There's certain increments that are called set out in the Clean Air Act where they make each region, basically state, set up its own implementation plan on how they're going to deal with their air quality. That was one way of decentralizing the issue, and they give certain allowances. And this sulfur dioxide will blow into the U.S. and will exceed the allowances for Big Bend National. There's also additional standards for siting near a Class 1 protected national park. And this, the emissions, projected emissions from the Carbon 2 plant will exceed those by 300% at Big Bend. So not only will that, could that hinder any future development in the U.S. or Mexican border region that want to develop in a region, their emissions, they will not be allowed to add any more, but it could also require existing U.S. facilities to reduce their emissions below what they're presently allowed to release.
If this power plant were in the U.S., what would be required of it?
A number of things. One is, for starters, it's just highly unlikely that he would even be allowed to be sited this close to a protected national park. It's only 100 miles from Big Bend, and I said everything will blow directly there. But the basic, they said the estimated emissions of sulfur dioxide will be, from this plant, the Carbon 2 plant alone, will be around 2.36 pounds per million BTU. By comparison, the U.S. standard is 1.2 pounds per million, and that's a maximum EPA standard. In addition to that, there's a standard requiring best available control technology. Under that, that would require reduction of emissions by another 90%. A typical plant, as I said, 2.36 pounds per million BTU is what Carbon 2 will put out. A typical plant right now in the U.S., if it were built today, would be held to about 0.1 to 0.2 pounds per million BTU. So we're talking at least an order of magnitude here, 10 to 20 times the amount of pollution a U.S. facility would put out.
Well, we've heard a lot in the press, especially on Alternative Views, about the U.S. environmental concerns with NAFTA. For instance, pollution coming over from Mexico or from U.S. companies, especially operating in Mexico, into the United States. Does Mexico have any environmental concerns that they are addressing the U.S. on?
Citizens of Mexico are. The Mexican government's not. There recently has been a lot of stir over the siting of nuclear waste facilities and other types of toxic hazardous waste facilities along the U.S. border. Everybody knows that it's quite common in this country for facilities to be sited where there's going to be the least public resistance. The people who are least empowered in this country typically get the worst of the environmental dumping. That's very clear in southwestern Texas. The people there are largely Hispanic or rural. They are not politically empowered, and consequently, many, many, many dumps are sited in that region. Also, with the coming of NAFTA, there's going to be a great deal more pressure for companies to enforce the provisions of bringing toxic waste from the maquiladoras back to the United States. Currently, they just dump it, bring it back to the United States for dumping. So that's another reason there's a lot of these waste dumps sited along the border.
I heard recently that the U.S. is putting a radioactive waste dump near the Mexican border. Is there any concern about this, and what are the specifics of the issue?
Exactly. Well, as I was saying, frequently there's a lot of these dumps in that area. We share the same air, we share the same water, share the same watersheds, aquifers, and recently the proposed nuclear waste facility at Sierra Blanca has been challenged, and just not long ago, several hundred Mexican residents came to the state of Texas, came to Austin, to oppose the siting of that dump there at Sierra Blanca.
This is a nuclear waste dump?
Right, a nuclear waste facility. The people there, the citizens, are clearly concerned. They don't have an official mechanism to address their grievances. They came up, they held a rally, they tried to make their concerns known, but as of yet, there's been no formal inquiry from the Mexican environmental agencies, and so the people are basically, it's a very grassroots movement, and they're very much on their own, and it's a lot of hands being, you know, held across borders now. A lot of brothers and sisters who live on other sides of the borders are both, you know, worried about these sightings because they affect everybody.
I think, in fairness, you should say, though, at the actual hearing for that radioactive waste site, what it was going to accept the residue from uranium mining. So it's not only is it radioactive waste, but it's a lot of heavy duty solvents put in to separate the uranium from the ore. But Mexico did send a member of Congress who came up and spoke and actually formally opposed the issuing of this permit for them to build this plant. And it's actually one of the first times that a Mexican government official has come and taken an active part in a U.S. proceeding on an environmental border dispute.
It seems that in a very complex economic issue, well, in the very complex economic issues that are going to evolve to the North American Free Trade Agreement, where there'll be literally thousands of relocations and movements across the border, that there needs to be some sort of formal mechanism for people to operate in, not just an informal sending of an official or something like that. And I'm wondering what your take is on the side agreements that the Clinton administration recently released, having to do with economic and labor issues. Are they going to create that kind of mechanism that's needed? Are they going to alleviate the situation at all?
These side agreements fall way short of doing anything like addressing problems similar to the one we've seen at Carbon 2. Most of what is, in summary, what is done is they're creating a commission on the environment. This is a cooperation council. All the language we've seen has been has used language that's non-binding, attempts to cooperate, attempts to commission studies to look into issues, to share information. But as far as anything with teeth, anything that would actually give American citizens or Mexican citizens a right to have their grievances heard about a siting of a facility, for example, there's nothing like that. Or in terms of teeth, penalties against corporations who are bad actors, there's nothing with any real enforcement. And the La Paz Agreement's a good example of what happens when you don't have an agreement that means something. These side agreements are very vague, very wishy-washy, and they don't really mean anything.
Chris, could you tell us about the La Paz Agreement, what its history is, and give us some examples of how legal issues across the border might be handled in the future?
The La Paz Agreement is called so for the place of its signing in 1988 by President Ronald Reagan and President de la Madrid of Mexico. And it was the first time border issues, border environmental problems, were recognized and addressed. Address is their term. It sets out several vague mandates on we should cooperate in the future. It's basically an agreement to agree again in the future. There has been some good things that have come out of it, such as these separate technical annexes to deal with specific problems, such as wastewater pollution, isolated incidents, smelters of copper and other ores that put a ton of sulfur dioxide into the air. And that has been somewhat effective in those specific technical annexes. But the agreement itself doesn't contain a whole lot. A lot of people say that it's great because it mandates sharing of information between U.S. agencies and environmental agencies and the Mexican environmental agencies, but that's not really true. It says that they should cooperate in the future and shall consider information exchanges such as. There's nothing actually requiring the agencies to share information, and they don't. With the Carbon 2 plant, the U.S. EPA asked for a copy of the environmental impact statement done by the Mexican government on the plant back, I think, in April, and they still have yet to get a reply. And similarly, on the U.S. side, the U.S. Mexico requested the U.S. EPA to get involved with the siting of these radioactive waste sites in the U.S. side of the border, and EPA would take no involvement at all, provide no information. So you see, there isn't really a strong history of cooperation there, and that is sort of what the side agreements are relying upon, saying, well, we should set up this pattern for negotiation and for agreement in the future. Cooperation, it's very unclear whether that cooperation will actually happen.
What consumer or environmental groups have been included in the constitution of the side agreements? Has there been an attempt to include the ordinary people or people, citizens groups? in this process?
Not our groups, that's for sure. I'm not clear on if they have consulted. I know that the process was closed and secretive, just as the negotiation of the original NAFTA text was. From my understanding, citizens don't really have a place in either the negotiations process or the dispute resolution process after there has been charge of a bad actor in one of the three countries.
If they are involved, I would say that their demands usually go unheeded. With the integrated, recently in 92, I think came out called the Integrated Environmental Border Plan. And what that was is basically viewed as a temporary pacifier to quell critics of NAFTA to ease its ratification in the U.S. There were a lot of concerns when it was being developed that U.S. environmental groups put forth, saying there are no solid enforcement measures in here. I think of the 87 identifiable commitments that were made in that agreement, over half of them amounted to, as I said, an agreement to agree again in the future, hold a meeting. Another 17% were to conduct studies and so forth. Only 6% of the 87 identifiable commitments actually decided to address a problem. And so if there is any input, it generally just goes unheeded.
You know, that can be seen, the fact that the lack of input from environmentalists or consumers, can be seen in what the outcome of this was. What they've agreed to is the creation of this commission, which will only deal enforcement-wise with non-enforcement of a country's own domestic environmental laws. In other words, the commission will only take any kind of action if a country's not enforcing its own environmental laws.
What's to stop a company, a U.S. company, say, from going right across the border and sending all kinds of pollution out into the air and ground, a pollution that may actually come into the U.S.?
Well, as far as the side agreements, that kind of question points to a glaring weakness. According to the side agreements, the only thing that's even enforceable at all after an arduous journey through a maze of procedures to get to a cause of action, the only thing that's enforceable at all is a country's non-enforcement of its own environmental laws. Clearly, Mexico has a number of good environmental laws on the books, as does the U.S. and Canada. However, we feel like that's a pretty weak standard to go by if that's the only thing that has any kind of enforcement mechanism at all. Clearly, with Carbon 2, they are complying with Mexican environmental laws, to our knowledge.
So they can send out all the sulfur dioxide they want into the air, I think solid particulates were just cited as one of the largest causes of cancer in the U.S., and as long as it doesn't break Mexican laws, it can come over into the national park across the border, it can go into Utah, Texas,
right.
New Mexico, and there's nothing we can do about
it. Well, and even if it were to break Mexican laws, it would take a pattern of non-enforcement over a great period of time. There's no timeline on any of this for procedures of us addressing the grievances. It would require both the U.S. and Canada to agree to bring some kind of action, and then it's very vague as to what that action would be, more than this Commission on the Environment encouraging Mexico to start enforcing its own law.
And even then, Mexico is having problems enforcing its laws as it is. They made a big deal about the fact, a great deal has been made about how they've hired all these additional environmental investigators and inspectors along the border region, but an article in the Times came out last week. They hadn't paid any of these people for 5 months, so of the 200 that they hired, they're now down to a handful because they haven't been paid. Additionally, although the amount of inspectors had doubled during the past 2 years, the GAO reported that the amount of permits applied for in Mexico has quadrupled. Not only that, but none of the selected sites that were inspected by the GAO had actually applied for the permits themselves. So permits have quadrupled, and the vast majority aren't even applying for permits. It's estimated that right now less than 3% of all industrial facilities in Mexico have the necessary permits. And regarding the the NAFTA implications, we don't know. I mean, there, with the carbon 2 plant, under NAFTA's provisions, it is likely that this plant will be able to sell power back into the U.S. And that is one of the fundamental core problems with the idea of free trade, or as it should be known, just deregulated international commerce. There's nothing free about it. It can affect. The problem is when a nation will internalize its environmental costs, as the U.S. does through its regulation of emissions and other ways, they're making a certain societal statement on how they want their economy to evolve. When you open up trade, when you deregulate trade across international boundaries, it's going to favor the country that doesn't internalize its environmental costs. So this system could set up this U.S. company Mission, even though the company is based in the U.S., set up this power plant in Mexico and then sell power with no environmental controls and then sell power back into the U.S. at a cost lower than companies' facilities that have to comply with the U.S. environmental standards can sell it.
How could this apply to things like food and whatnot? We regulate the amount of pesticides in our food. We passed a law banning the consumption of tuna that was caught with dolphin dangerous nets. What sort of a fallout can we see from that?
Well, people say that these problems will never happen under these trade agreements, that there's no way we'd ever actually lower our standards. People would go, people wouldn't stand for it. But the problem is, it's not that blatant. It's a lot more covert. With the tuna, the way they rectified the tuna case was they passed something called the Marine Mammal Protection Act, which actually did the exact opposite. It removed several marine mammals from protection, and with such as instances of food. That's a big issue with international trade, is the amount of pesticides that are included on food. And although it says in some of the agreements, GATT and NAFTA, that they will not be allowed to import things that don't meet the U.S.'s own standards, those standards can be challenged. And even if they're not challenged, say with pesticides, the U.S. is now, also again recently in the Times, that the U.S. is itself considering lifting its ban on the addition of cancer-causing substances to food, saying that it will cause us to ban too many pesticides. But there might be a more sinister element to that, in that it's going to open it up for trade from Mexico. So if the pesticides...
So you think that there could be subtle political pressure put in through the free trade agreement to lift certain bans, like the ban on DDT or whatnot, on our own food consumption?
Certainly, because it's not going to be the countries that are challenging these bans. It's going to be the U.S. corporations who stand to profit from the ban being lifted.
Well, taking another tack, people say that there's going to be an economic crisis in Mexico if NAFTA isn't passed. What do you think about this?
Well, Mexico is in a pretty precarious position right now, as it is. Right now, the Mexican government has undertaken a policy of low wages and keeping the peso overvalued. At some point, they're going to have to devalue the peso. Whether that's before or after NAFTA is ratified, we don't know. This is going to cause some disruptions in Mexico. Whether NAFTA gets passed or not, there are certain problems inherent in this speculative bubble that's going on in Mexico that are going to cause some disruptions. Whether that should be a concern to U.S. policymakers is a good question. I think that we know there are problems with structural problems with the Mexican economy caused by the policies of the Salinas government, policies which have attracted a great deal of capital in flight from other countries to finance the debt, payment of the debt, and to maintain some of these large growth projects. Now, if NAFTA is not ratified, there's a good chance that this speculative bubble on the Mexican stock market might actually burst. The ramifications to the Mexican people are not real clear. Now, with or without NAFTA, you have to remember that bubble is going to burst. When the peso is devalued, capital is going to flow back out. when the peso is devalued, the U.S. trade surplus with Mexico will likely reverse itself into, again, a trade deficit with Mexico. These are some pretty technical issues that that people within the Mexican government have been battling over for quite some time. Political timing, economic timing, it's all tied in together. The question needs to be looked at in terms of how that should be dealt with in the U.S. policy debate. Do we have a responsibility to prop up this regime in Mexico? Are we going to base the decisions that are going to affect hundreds of thousands of U.S. workers on whether or not the Mexican stock market bubble bursts now or 6 months from now? You know, those are some questions that I think the answer to is we need to go on with our policy debate, looking at what's in the best interest of the environment, what's in the best interest of U.S. workers, and indeed what's in the best interest probably of the vast majority of workers within Mexico, not based on what's in the interest of stockholders and banks who've invested high, you know, invested speculatively in a market driven by promises and a whimsy.
From what the two of you said, it seems like NAFTA is only going to benefit one class of people, or even non-people, that's corporations and their stockholders. You painted a picture where the ratification of the agreement will create environmental chaos on the border, a lot of pollution coming into the U.S. that we haven't had in the past, and a dislocation possibly of Mexican workers as well as U.S. workers. So I'd like to ask each of you, what do you think can be done to fix this agreement, if anything? Chris?
Well, I think at the to fix the agreement, there's arguments whether the agreement should be fixed at all, but or scrapped. But to fix the agreement, at the very least, you would need to put some solid enforcement measures, saying if there is an environmental challenge, a problem, that can be challenged publicly by citizens, and that there be a specific means of addressing those problems. Additionally, that when a problem comes up and is caused by a certain actor, that actor will be able to be directly fined rather than fining an already a government that already has a significant overdemand on its resources. By fining the Mexican government, you're not going to have a direct effect on a Dow chemical company that's pumping pollution into the Rio Grande. Also, you should make all matters completely open to public disclosure. Under the present supplemental accords, any information about an environmental infringement can be withheld by consent of the other two parties. So it won't take long for these parties to realize that they're all doing something bad at some point, and then agreeing to just ban the public release of this information anytime. That's what presently happens in the La Paz Agreement. No information can be made available to the public without the consent of both parties, and so both parties never consent to having the information released. Lastly, I would make sure that there is a way to clean up the border region, and one proposed measure is the development of a multilateral development bank, a new one separate from the World Bank, to lend money to certain groups to go in and clean up some of the problems. That's in the supplemental accords. It's not sure. That could be a good idea if it's done well, but you've really got to ensure that it's not just a mechanism by one company goes in and profits from polluting, another company goes in and profits from cleaning up, and the U.S. taxpayers, through the development bank, just assure any risk of the corporate action. And you've got to look at these situations. You've got to look at these vague accords in the supplemental agreement in their worst possible case scenario. Whether you look at it under the, say, well, the Clinton administration, they might be laxist. I mean, depends on whether you view the Clinton administration as a honeymoon, as some have, or as a date rape, as others have. Imagine worst case scenario, 4 or 5 years down the road. Imagine Phil Gramm in charge of this agency that's going to be required to pursue these environmental infringements. As we saw, with the Interior Ministry under Reagan, if the executive it places too much power in the hands of the executive branch in power at that time.
So you see this You see, the NAFTA is just another way of the ordinary citizens ceding their sovereignty, ceding their rights to regulate their own environment and government to government agencies.
Sure, yes, and that's a whole thing of, I view the whole goal of some of these deregulation of international commerce agreements. There's always been regulation. That's the term free trade. That's how regulation got started to begin with, was to protect the government being responsive to the needs of the citizens, to protect them from the actions of profit-seeking corporations, who are less likely to observe social and environmental matters.
James, what's your take on these issues? Is there anything salvageable about NAFTA or useful in it?
Well, the concept is useful, and international agreements open borders can be done right. I frankly don't think there's anything salvageable about this NAFTA. You know, they're going to have to take it back, scrap it, and start all over again. There's too many fundamental problems. Like, even with the development of a development bank, what that's going to wind up doing is putting U.S. taxpayers in charge of cleaning up a mess caused by U.S. corporations. So in other words, the corporations get not only to throw workers out of work, move the jobs across the border, start polluting the border region, and then here comes the U.S. taxpayers to clean up the mess. But a more fundamental problem with that is development banks are used to, they're profit-seeking, and cleaning up pollution is not exactly a very profitable venture. What they're going to do is issue bonds to finance this border cleanup. Well, I don't know about you, but if I'm looking to invest money, you're going to do it where there's a return. So I've very distinct fear and that this development bank will be used to develop infrastructure needs and things to help commerce, things that have a payback, and the actual cleanup of toxics and things like that will get left undone, because the municipalities cannot afford to pay back. A development bank works by being paid back. These municipalities can't afford to clean up their own mess right now, or the mess that's caused by the U.S. corporations. It's very unlikely that they're going to have the money to make this a profitable venture, and that these bonds will inevitably be defaulted on, and they're backed up by the U.S. taxpayer, who according to the models that have been shown, will be responsible for picking up the tab if there's a default. Now, after having said all this, none of this is even on paper yet. With the announcement of the side agreements, they talked about this concept of a development bank, but even the concepts that I've just discussed, even none of them have actually even been put down. So I think we're real unlikely to get even that much when all is said and done. So my feeling is, start over again. Development bank concept is a good idea. Rich countries should put something into helping the cleanup of the mess. But I would see it funded more from a mechanism by which the corporations who benefit from moving jobs across the border, that they themselves, they're benefiting from free trade, they should be paying for this cleanup.
Sure. Well, U.S. taxpayers, look out. Sounds like free trade in the 90s sounds a lot like deregulation in the 80s. It seems like our government and the big corporations that support it, that give the money for the politicians that are fighting so hard for NAFTA right now, both here and in Mexico, are just looking for another way to sop up profits and to issue bonds that will never get repaid. And once again, the U.S. taxpayer in the end is going to have to foot the bill.
You're watching Alternative Views. And now let's have some news stories from the Alternative Press.
The question on many American minds is, why are we in Somalia? Is it truly for humanitarian purposes, as they would have us believe, or could it be for natural resources such as oil? According to the now infamous LA Times article on January 19th, written by Mark Feynman, before the overthrow of Siad Barre in 1991, two-thirds of Somalia was allocated to four major oil companies: Conoco, Amco, Chevron, and Phillips.
Conoco is the only multinational corporation that's maintained an office in Mogadishu, for the past 2 years. A 1991 World Bank study shows that Sudan and Somalia are sitting atop of the largest untapped oil resources in the world.
So the question that a lot of people are asking is, the restoration of stability benefiting the Somalian people, as they would have us believe, or major U.S. oil companies?
The link between multinational corporations and oil companies goes back as far as the 50s, when the United Security Council secret paper established oil companies as instruments of foreign policy. This goes forward from the 50s into the 60s with Vietnam, and most recently into the Middle East. The Conoco office apparently has served as a de facto U.S. embassy for the troops as they arrived in Mogadishu. I called Conoco in Houston and talked to their manager of public relations, Jim Felder, to confirm the information that was in the LA Times piece. He didn't deny any of the relevant information, which importantly talked about the fact that Conoco has been the staging area for the troops and the living compound for our troops as they are brought into Somalia. It continues to be the living compound area. And there's questionable links between why are multinational corporations and military intervention linked together in such a way. He said that it is ridiculous as far as trying to link oil companies and military intervention because, according to him, it is a dry hole. They have not yet discovered oil there. He's granting that they'd like to discover oil. They hope that they can find oil, but as of now, they still haven't found any oil in Somalia.
Well, they haven't done a heck of a lot there. Yeah, that's the thing. They wouldn't be there. The oil companies wouldn't be there if they didn't think there was a lot of oil there. And it's certainly reasonable to assume that the oil isn't going to stop at the borders. So obviously there is a lot of oil there, and that's the reason they're there. You remember, now you're not old enough to remember, but Kelly is.
Hi.
Yeah, Vietnam War, where the peace activists were saying the reason we're over there, mainly the primary reason, is natural resources, specifically oil. There are a lot of oil reserves off the Vietnam coast. And the Rockefellers and the establishment people in the State Department saying, oh, no, that isn't over there. We're fighting communism. We're there to help those people out in Vietnam. The oil doesn't have anything to do with it. Well, just about 1992 or 91, little bitty articles here that said, well, the United States has admitted that there's a lot of oil off the east coast of Vietnam, and they want to, the oil companies are wanting to go over there and start grabbing it. It always made sense, though, because they admitted that there was oil off the east coast of China, and it didn't make much sense to think that the oil would just stop once it hit the once they hit the demarcation line between Vietnam and China. So oil, that's what runs the State Department.
Frank, in the 60s, there was a paper put out by the Asia Society recommending a complete commitment to our presence in Vietnam. The Asia Society's president was John D. Rockefeller III, and also, the Rockefeller family controlled a large amount of the stock, or owned a large amount of the stock, in Saucony Mobile. As it turns out, Saucony Mobile made most of their profits from the Far East.
It even goes back further than that, if we can stretch this story out some more. Back before the Americans got into World War II, the Council on Foreign Relations, that bedrock organization of the American power structure, had a study where they said, hey, the resources and natural resources are in abundance in Southeast Asia, and we want to have those resources for our corporations. But Japan is threatening us. We want to keep Japan out of Southeast Asia at all costs because we want those natural resources. They said we don't have the military power to get to pry Japan out, and the American people wouldn't stand for us going in there for natural resources, because what we got to do is to lure Japan into attacking the United States, because then the Americans will support such a war. Well, we see the genesis of the Vietnam War back before World War II, and that is that they want all those resources there. It's a very rich part of the world. And now, Somalia, Iraq, same thing.
Colombia.
USGI's committed as guards. American forces are once again being committed to a clandestine war for the benefit of the Rockefeller internationalist elite.
Is that a new story from the Spotlight?
From the Spotlight.
Yeah, what else does it say?
U.S. forces are becoming involved in a secret war for control of vast new oil wealth discovered recently in Colombia by a Rockefeller-led syndicate of explorers. The Spotlight has learned exclusively from officials and commercial sources. Colombian diplomats at UN headquarters have confirmed that the oil reserves found in their nation's eastern frontier regions are now being privately compared to Kuwait's fabulous black gold bonanza.
Uh-huh. It all ties together, doesn't it?
Say, Doug, I heard something this afternoon that reminded me of when I was going to college in the 50s, the old McCarthyite Red Scare loyalty oath. I happened to hear a message that was coming in for you. They're inviting you to speak at a Florida university. And they said, but before you can get your money, you got to sign the loyalty oath to the state of Florida.
That's
Have
true.
You heard that? Is that really?
That's true. I just talked to the people that invited me who were very embarrassed about it and said that every time this comes up, it's a cause for humor. But evidently, any time money from the state of Florida is paid for lectures or consultants or anyone else, you have to sign a loyalty oath. So I have to swear that I am loyal to the state of Florida and do not intend to overthrow its government.
And that's Alternative Views. Frequently hear from viewers who request a list of news publications, which we use on Alternative Views, and also a reading list for U.S. power structure in the mass media. If you would like to have these, send a stamped, self-addressed envelope to the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. You must send a self-addressed stamped envelope. We'd like to thank some people who helped make the program possible. Brian Lynch was our director and also set the lights. Kelly Hope and Erica Olivares, also part of the crew, as well as Kristen Thigpen, Trent Freeman, and Travis Goff. And Eric Eubank and Kevin L. West were our production crew for one of the news segments. Alternative Views is a production of the Alternative Information Network, P.O. Box 7279, Austin, Texas, 78713. This is our 506th program in the Alternative Views series, and we've just completed our 15th year of production. So we're quite proud of ourselves, particularly with a budget of around $2,000 to $3,000 a year. Bye.